week is how social justice came to America. Social justice came to America in two stages. First, with FDR and his New Deal. And secondly, with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I propose to tell you what happened with the second of these events, since I only have 20 minutes. This will have to suffice to deal with the second topic. But I'm going to begin by addressing the question that our chairman raised as to what is social justice. What does this term mean? A subject on which many conservatives, amazingly, are not at all clear. Social justice, as currently understood, I don't mean as it ought to be understood, but as it is widely understood, is the theory that justice consists not in the right way for one individual to treat another, but in a condition of fairness or equality in society. According to this theory, a state of inequality in society, such as poverty or inequality of power, is not merely bad or regrettable, but unjust. The great advantage of anything that is unjust is that it entitles you to use force to overcome it. Although many people are misled by the name into thinking social justice must be a form of genuine justice, or at least compatible with ordinary justice, it is in fact a very big departure from ordinary justice. Fairness means treating people equally. But justice means treating them as they deserve. True justice is impartial, but social justice favours some over others. True justice helps every institution in society to achieve the distinctive goals for which it was founded. But social justice imposes on all institutions the additional and usually conflicting goal of making society more equal, and the compulsion to aim at this additional goal frequently undermines the institution. True justice and injustice are qualities of actions which individuals do, and for which they are therefore responsible. Because all ethical qualities are ultimately qualities of a will. But poverty or other conditions of inequality in society are not actions, or the product of actions done by anybody. They are not qualities of a will, and no one need be responsible for them. Social justice cuts the essential link between ethical judgment and individual responsibility, to the great detriment of human life and society. It is not justice at all, but only fake or pseudo-justice. I'm going to go on now to the second of the stages by which it made its way to these shores. And for those of you who have few who have copies of my paper, this is numbered paragraph 3 on page 5. The version of social justice that President Roosevelt had espoused in his New Deal was limited to questions of economics, poverty, and unemployment. Since then, however, the conception of justice has undergone a further revolution, focusing especially on race and sex. This second and twofold revolution was brought about by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The original purpose of that bill, as stated by President Kennedy in his speech proposing it to Congress in June of the previous year, was mainly to eliminate the system of racial segregation. In his words, giving all Americans the right to be served in facilities which are open to the public, hotels, restaurants, theatres, retail stores, and similar establishments, unquote, as well as, quote, greater protection for the right to vote. So those were the two focuses of the bill in his mind, getting rid of segregation and furthering the right to vote. Now, this aim of eliminating segregation was fully in accord, I'm sure we will all agree, with ordinary justice. It was entirely right and proper and long overdue. Despite that, the bill at first encountered fierce opposition. In August, however, the Reverend Martin Luther King gave a speech, a famous speech, I Have a Dream, pleading for racial harmony. And this speech had a powerful effect. Over the Christmas holiday period, the nation experienced a remarkable change of heart. When Congress reassembled in the spring, it was found that opposition to the bill had greatly diminished. As the bill worked its way through Congress's committee system, however, its purpose and its nature were substantially changed by the addition of two amendments that belong not to the realm of ordinary justice, but to that of social justice. One was a vast broadening of its scope from the elimination of segregation, as the President intended in his speech, to the elimination of discrimination in all places of employment with more than 15 employees. This was a momentous change. And to explain how momentous, I'd like for a moment to speak about two things. First, discrimination, and secondly, employers and their rights. Previously to 1964, discrimination was the name of a virtue. A person of discrimination was someone who possessed a fine power of judgment, able to tell the difference between the good and the less good, or the beautiful and the not so beautiful. But now the word was captured by the liberals and twisted to their purposes, just like the word liberal itself, which they have captured and twisted. And this capture of the word discrimination was for the purpose of expanding the powers of the state at the expense of the rights of employers. Since 1964, we have all been brainwashed to think of discrimination as a vice. But I would like you to rethink this word for the purpose of making an important distinction between coercive discrimination and peaceful discrimination. President Kennedy wanted, rightly, to eliminate segregation. Segregation was a system of coercive discrimination involving the use of force against people who had done nothing to deserve it. And it was therefore a detestable offence against ordinary justice. But simple or non-coercive discrimination, and what I am going to call peaceful discrimination, belongs in an entirely different moral category. Segregation causes harm because it employs coercion. But peaceful discrimination does not involve coercion and does not cause harm. For it's possible to discriminate peacefully against a person without performing any actions at all in regard to him or her. All that is necessary to be guilty of this crime is to give a benefit to somebody else. This is the kind of discrimination that can take place in commerce, for example, in employment. I'll give a recent example here, although more properly it perhaps belongs with my next point. Not long ago, in a New York court, now I should preface this by saying that I'm going to be touching on sensitive topics here, and I realise that, and I want to treat them sensitively. Nonetheless, I feel it is necessary for us to be able to discuss these questions. Not long ago in the New York court, the pharmaceutical firm Novartis was fined several million dollars for paying its male salesman $75 a month more than its female sales force. The women were not defrauded. They were not robbed or injured. Their condition was not in any way worsened, which is the definition of harm. All that happened was that a benefit was given to the men. The benefit to the men was treated as if it were an injury to the women. Their treatment was unequal, but it was not unjust, as injustice is ordinarily understood. Neither in Roman law nor in Anglo-American common law was there ever a crime of discrimination. This confusion of mere inequality or unfairness with injustice is the hallmark of social justice. What was and remains at stake in this legislation is the natural rights of employers. It's the employer who creates the job and who pays for it. Consequently, the job belongs to the employer, not to the employee, and not to the government, nor to society. The employer has the natural moral right to decide who shall take the job and who not, and what the conditions of work, including the salary, should be. No one else has that right. But the Civil Rights Act of 1964 proceeds as if the government has this right. And this is a gross injustice to employers. Before this act was passed, almost everyone understood employers' rights and generally accepted them. But for 50 years now, these basic rights of employers have been all but ignored. But not entirely. Curiously, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 itself actually recognises the moral legitimacy of peaceful discrimination because the prohibition does not kick in until you have 16 employees. So long as you only have 14 employees, the law rightly allows you to discriminate as much as you like. But if you have 16 employees, it's pretended, absurdly, that the essential nature of justice changes radically, and as an employer, you become liable to serious penalties. Furthermore, for an action to be genuinely immoral or a crime, it must be done with an evil intention, mens rea in the technical term. The interior dimension of actions is always a central aspect of them for moral judgment. But in 1971, the Supreme Court decided that it is possible to be guilty of discrimination even unintentionally, namely when an action has a disparate impact on protected groups. That is, when it creates inequality. This epoch-making amendment to the bill, wrongly prohibiting peaceful discrimination in employment, was included chiefly through the efforts of one Asa Philip Randolph, who persuaded Representative Emmanuel Seller, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who introduced the bill into the House, to accept it. Randolph was a member of the Socialist Party and had organised and led the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the first predominantly black labour union. In 1941, he had organised the March on Washington movement to pressure President Roosevelt, successfully as it turned out, into banning discrimination in defence industries. In 1948, he had successfully pressured President Harry Truman to end segregation in the armed services. He had helped organise the March on Washington in 1963, which gave rise to President Kennedy's civil rights speech and bill. Randolph was perhaps the most radical of the black civil rights leaders, and as you can see from my account, was already experienced in arguing for the banning of peaceful discrimination. The second great alteration to the Civil Rights Bill of 1963 was the addition of the word sex. The original concern of the Civil Rights Act, as of the civil rights movement, was restricted to the question of race. The bill made no mention of sex. This amendment was added to the bill in the House by Howard Smith, chairman of the Rules Committee. On February the 8th, at a sparsely attended Saturday session, with the final vote in the House looming, at the last minute, Smith offered an amendment to additionally prohibit discrimination in employment on the grounds of sex. Representative Carl Elliott from Alabama later explained, "Smith didn't give a damn about women's rights. He was trying to knock off votes, either then or down the line, that is in the Senate, because there was always a hard core of men who didn't favour women's rights." Onlookers tell us that Smith's amendment was initially greeted by hoots of laughter from the floor. I say this to indicate, I'm going to say this for a couple of paragraphs, what passed for debate on this epoch-making bill. He read from a letter to, quote, "to show you how some of the ladies feel about discrimination against them," unquote, that he had received from a Nebraska woman upset about the nation's, quote, "surplus of spinsters," unquote. He explained, quote, "through interruptions of howling laughter," quote, "her demand that Congress should equalize the sexual ratio in the population," and recited her indignant charge that instead of, quote, "instead of assisting these poor, unfortunate females in obtaining their right to happiness, the government has on several occasions engaged in wars which killed off a large number of eligible males," unquote. Congressman George Andrews from Alabama thereupon shouted, "Unless this amendment is adopted, white women of this country would be drastically discriminated against in favour of a Negro woman," unquote. Emanuel Sella tried to kill the amendment with ridicule, criticising it as unnecessary because of the, quote, delightful accord, unquote, that had prevailed in his own household for 50 years. Quote, I usually have the last two words, and those words are, yes, dear, unquote. But female members of the House, there were 12 of them at the time, apparently unaware that the amendment on sex was intended by its mover, not for its own sake, but for the purpose of killing the bill on race, took it on its merits. Martha Griffith, a Democrat from Missouri, declared, "A vote against this amendment today by a white man is a vote against his wife or his daughter or his sister," unquote. Catherine St. George from New York argued, quote, "We are entitled to this little crumb of equality. The addition of that little terrifying word, S-E-X, will not hurt this legislation in any way," unquote. Suddenly, what had been nothing more than a ploy to both mock the bill and poison its passage in the Senate was taken with literal seriousness and transformed into a live question. The amendment eventually passed by a vote of 168 to 133. In this ironic manner, now I should perhaps have pointed out that the feminist movement had not got off the ground, or scarcely got off the ground by this point. It didn't develop until after the Civil Rights Act. In this ironic manner, with no public debate, especially no political demand, no congressional hearings, and no national debate, and as the result of a misunderstanding, did social justice in the form of women's liberation come to America. Again, the question of justice here is about the rights of employers, whether they are men or women. To repeat, it is the employer who creates the job and pays for the job. Consequently, the job belongs to the employer, not to the employee, not to the government, not to society. The employer, whether man or woman, has a natural right to hire whomever he or she wishes. Women may feel that they have benefited by this law prohibiting peaceful discrimination on the ground of sex, but they are not benefited if they are employers. By the Civil Rights Act of 1964, American women were deprived of the right in law to hire only women, or to found commercial associations consisting only of women, which is and ought to be their natural right, which in certain circumstances they may find useful. In other countries, for example in Europe, there are large orchestras consisting only of women. Corporations can be run exclusively by and for women, and there are public parking spaces reserved for women, typically near exits. So far as I've been able to discover from the historical records of the congressional debate, and I confess I'm not finished with that task yet, but so far as I've been able to discover, the question of employers' rights, at least in the debate in the House, was not even discussed. No doubt it's true that more women are employees than employers, but the injustice of the law remains. The present time, when our nation is looking to employers to provide more jobs, would be an especially intelligent time to recognise that they have natural moral rights and that those rights are being seriously violated by our current law. The question has been discussed here, what to do about the poor. So in that connection, I would like to make a reference, finally, to Pope Leo XIII in his famous encyclical on the working classes, Rerum Novarum, where he says that the task of government is to create a regime of genuine justice, not of compassion, not of special treatment, but a regime of impartial, genuine justice. And I would like to finally recommend that as a, seems to me, a sound conservative rule. Well, thank you.
Thank you.